in 41 years. Janet and Janine Africa can walk down a city street unencumbered. For them, Philadelphia is surely not the city of brotherly love. Janet and Janine Africa are the last MOVE women held after the MOVE confrontation of August 8, 1978, when cops attacked the West Philadelphia MOVE house. Several MOVE brothers remain. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
WBAI New York. Stay tuned for Code Pink, Women for Peace.
This is Medea Benjamin, and co-hosting with me this morning is
Arielle Gold.
And this is our first show. We're so excited to be initiating our new radio show on two wonderful Pacifica stations. That's WPFW in D.C.
and WBAI in New York City. And this is Code Pink Radio. You can listen live at 89.3 in Washington, D.C., at 99.5 in New York City. You can listen online at wbai.org/listen live, or you can download the app, the WPFW app on your phone, or the Pacifica Radio app on your phone.
So many, many ways to listen to us. And we will be bringing you every week on Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time news about what Code Pink is up to, as well as some of the critical foreign policy issues that you're not hearing about very much. And just to give an example, was last night the Democratic debates. There were 6 minutes out of, 2.5 hours of
that
debate
was a
time?
Long debate.
And 6 minutes on foreign policy. And basically, it was just one quick question given to Andrew Yang about about Afghanistan, and then there was a desperate plea by de Blasio saying, please, can we talk about Iran?
And it didn't really happen. And
no,
this
he was shut down immediately.
And this goes on continuously, that foreign policy, all of the wars that we're in, the enormously bloated Pentagon budget are ignored.
At least we had Tulsi Gabbard getting in there and saying something about how we should bring our troops home and use the money that would be saved to invest in all the needs we have here. And, of course, we do hear Bernie Sanders saying that. But in terms of what you hear when we go, as we do every week, to the halls of our Congress, where we go to the hearings, what we're hearing is a very one-sided view of U.S. foreign policy, which is basically how do we continue to use our military as the hammer instead of using diplomacy? How do we continue to these are the policies that now go back since 9/11, the endless wars that we have been in, instead of how do we do what the American people, left, right, in between, want us to do, which is get out of these wars and stop new ones. And so that's what we'll be talking about, as well as inspiring examples around the world of what people are doing to change their governments. And today, I wanted Ariel to maybe talk about some of the updates around the Israel-Palestine work.
Sure. So one of the wars that we are in to a degree is the war on the Palestinian people, and we, the U.S., are in that war by giving $3.8 billion a year to Israel to carry out this war. Now, last week in Congress, we saw a pretty ugly resolution attacking Palestinian rights, attacking the movement to bring freedom and equality to Palestinians, pass overwhelmingly in the House. Only 17 Democratic members of Congress voted against this measure that falsely said that boycotting Israel is inherently anti-Semitic. Now, we have a silver lining here. We also have some really good news. Introduced just the week before that, so it's a brand new resolution, is a resolution introduced by Representative Ilhan Omar, who we all love.
Ilhan.
Speaking of champions on foreign policy, and this resolution.
And Rashida Tlaib.
And Rashida Tlaib, and wait for it, Representative John Lewis.
Amazing, because?
Well, first of all, John Lewis has been in Congress, I believe, since it was 1989. He is the longest standing member of the Black Caucus. And Representative John Lewis is actually pro-Israel. Now, this resolution affirms the role that boycotts have played in American history, from the Boston Tea Party to the boycott during World War II of products from Germany. So this is House Resolution 496, and it's moving forward and collecting co-sponsors, and it's really fabulous.
And it says, doesn't mention the word Israel, but everybody knows that's what it's about, giving us the right to use our consumer dollars the way we want to advocate for Palestinian rights. And we're excited about that. And if people want to help us to work on that, what can they do?
You can go to our website, codepink.org/right2BDS, and take action to tell your representative in Congress to become a co-sponsor of House Resolution 496.
Wonderful. And I think now we're going to have our first guest on, because Israel is one of the countries that has been pushing for the U.S. to go to war with Iran. While Bill de Blasio last night was shouting, let's talk about Iran, let's talk about Iran, that is what we want to do right now. And our guest is someone, do we have her on the phone, Susan?
Yes.
Wonderful. So our guest is somebody I admire so much, Susan Tomasebi, who is the executive director of a group called Femina, which maybe you could start by telling us about, and is also on the advisory board of Code Pink for the Iran program. And we are deeply grateful to you for all the wisdom that you have shared with us and with the world. So thank you for being on with us, Susan.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Congratulations on your radio program. It's great that you have this platform and can share your wisdom and the wisdom of the people who work with you on important issues in foreign policy and around peace. Thank you for having me. So Femina is a newly established organization. We're about 2 years old, and we work largely in the Middle East and North Africa and parts of Asia. And we work largely in contexts that are closed for civil society, or closing, shrinking space for civil society. We work to elevate the voices of women human rights defenders, their organizations, and their movements. And our primary focus is feminist groups in those countries who have progressive values and progressive agendas for change.
Speaking of that, of course, is so important to talk about how do feminists within Iran feel about what's going on? How have you been working with them to try to stop another war?
Yeah, well, I think the situation is pretty desperate. And, you know, yesterday the U.S. Administration, the Trump administration, designated Iran's foreign minister, as a sanctioned person, which is extremely problematic in the sense that, you know, we had hoped that this impasse and the increasingly tense situation would be diffused by both parties agreeing to some form of negotiations. And we thought we were going towards this with Senator Paul meeting with Zarif while he was in New York just recently in July, and then some sort of declarations on the Iranian side saying that we're willing to engage in negotiations as long as they're equal, as long as they don't expect us, you know, to fully submit to, you know, to all the demands. And so, you know, personally, at least, I thought that we were moving towards this, towards negotiation and somehow diffusing some of the tensions. But I think this designation is problematic in the sense that it just shows that the U.S. administration, despite the fact that it's been claiming all along that it's up for negotiations and wants to engage negotiations with Iran, is actually not at all committed to diplomacy. Because why else would they sanction the top diplomat of Iran? Making it impossible to engage in any way with that country to diffuse tension. So I think people are nervous about the possibility of war, the threat of war. It's difficult to live with that on a daily basis. The sanctions are definitely taking a toll. The worsening economic situation is taking a toll on people and on civil society. It's impacting people economically. The rial has lost, you know, three quarters of its value since 2015. And following the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA, the Iran deal. So people are feeling the pressures economically. And this is the intent of the U.S. government as well, is that they have a maximum pressure campaign. That, you know, while they claim that they're not looking for regime change, much of their rhetoric is about regime change, but also they want to put maximum pressure economically on Iran to possibly end up so that Iran ends up as a failed state.
I want to remind our listeners that we will be taking calls and you can ask Susan questions. You can call in at 202-588-0893. We'll be taking those calls shortly. So if you want to call in and get on hold in just a few minutes, but in the meantime, we'll continue the conversation.
So, Susan, yeah. I wanted to ask you about the sanctions and not only how they're affecting people inside Iran and what are some of the really worst aspects of that, but also how you feel about the role of the Europeans, the Chinese, the Russians, the others who have signed on to the nuclear agreement, but really haven't done enough to try to counter what the Trump administration is doing.
Well, let me talk just a little bit about how, like, the practical ways how these sanctions are actually hurting people. And I'll focus on women because this is where I, you know, the area in which I work. So women are, you know, whether they're the main breadwinners or not, they're responsible largely for the household finances. So the worsening economic situation is putting a lot of stress on women, and we've talked to women, and they have come up with a number of strategies for dealing with a worsening economic situation and their, you know, fast sort of move into poverty, you know, from if they were poor already, they're becoming even poorer, but if they're middle class, they're moving into, you know, they're becoming poor very fast. And so what women do initially is they cut from their own health care, from any luxury items. They stop buying creams, they stop buying medicine, they stop going to the spa, that, you know, things like that. But then they cut from their own health care, so even if they're sick, they're chronically ill, they don't seek medical care because it's too expensive. The cost of drugs, the cost of treatment has become really expensive, and families can't afford it. Some people with chronic illnesses, they often choose not to subject their family to that kind of economic pressure. Women also, initially, when they, you know, start having a hard time managing the household budget, they stop eating certain foods that are more expensive, like dairy products or vegetables or meat. And this is, you know, this has been going on for some time, so that their families can eat. But then eventually they have to cut those products out of their family's table as well. And, you know, I think some of the women that we've talked to talked about how they've had to move. They've had to, you know, make their household smaller. They've had to sell their homes if they own homes to, you know, become renters. Some move to other cities. So they're, you know, we have a opposite kind of migration happening now, that where a lot of Iranians were moving from the rural areas to cities. Now they have to move out of the cities, which are more expensive, to more inexpensive places. And, you know, obviously women have a hard time because they're the first ones to be let go out of employment. And there's policy that actually asks for this. You know, there are a lot of policymakers who are conservative. They have offered, as a solution to the worsening economic situation, is that women should quit, voluntarily quit, or be laid off, so that the men who are household, you know, who are the main breadwinners, should have those jobs. So women are being forced out of the market, especially in the service industry, which has been really hit extremely hard by the worsening economic situation, where many women are employed. So it's having a really negative impact on Iranians, on their daily lives, and especially on women. And, of course, in other places where sanctions have been implemented, we see a rise in early marriage among girls. We see dropout rates for young girls for schools. And, you know, it obviously impacts women's employment in those countries as well. So this is some of what's been happening in Iran. I think that China, Russia, those other countries, the Europeans, they, you know, they're also, going back to your question, they're also committed to live up to the Iran deal, to these negotiations, which was, you know, negotiations that the world community was engaged in. They haven't been able to do it because the U.S. sanctions are so far-reaching. They don't just sanction and punish the Iranians. They punish everybody who actually deals with Iranians. And Europeans, at least, they can't necessarily control their private sector, right? So the private sector is hesitant to engage with Iran because they're afraid of the U.S. taking action against them. And the Europeans can't force them. But I think, you know, in terms of China and Russia, well, they're, you know, perhaps, you know, they have shown some signs of wanting to support Iran and live up to the deal, but they haven't been able to necessarily come through in a real tangible way. But the U.S. Has a lot of power. I mean, the U.S. is like a bully in the playground, and it's throwing its weight around, even and it tends to be winning even with the bigger actors like China and Russia in this case.
So I believe we have somebody calling in with a question. Go ahead, caller.
In 1996, Leslie Stahl asked the question of Secretary of State Madeleine Albright on 60 Minutes. Quote, we have heard that 500,000 children have died on sanctions on Iraq. We've heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And, you know, is the price worth it? Madeleine Albright, quote, said, I think it is very hard, a hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it. Now, we've had two progressive regimes and a so-called moderate Republican regime in between, and it seems that Donald Trump has just brought that weaponization of sanctions to the fore. What makes you think that even if we had a Bernie Sanders or someone like this as a in president's chair, that these things would change?
Susan, you want to answer that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they will change with Bernie Sanders. I mean, I think Bernie Sanders is, you know, I personally really like his perspective, you know, his politics on the Middle East. I think he has progressive politics on the Middle East, and he talks about the power dynamics in ways that perhaps many other U.S., you know, representatives in Congress and in the House of Representatives and in the Senate don't, or are not willing to see in that way. I think, so I hope that if somebody progressive is in office, that the U.S. administration would really rethink both its policies in the broader Middle East, but its policies towards Iran and its policies of sanctions. I mean, the U.S. is sanctioning everybody to death. This is this is really a problem. It's become, you know, sanctions should be, you know, are sort of a coercive tool. They're a coercive tool for governments, but then also for the international community, but they need to have an end result, an end goal in mind. And, you know, I was opposed to sanctions I mean, Iran, first of all, Iran has been sanctioned for close to 40 years by the U.S., right? But the sanctions, that brought Iran to the table, the sanctions that were intended to bring Iran to the table that resulted in the Iran deal, I was critical of them because I thought that, you know, and many, many other civil society activists and women's movement activists were critical of them because they really hurt the Iranian people, just as the sanctions are hurting Iranian people now. But if the administration is thinking that there's an end goal and the end goal was to reach an agreement on Iran's nuclear program, then it achieved the end goal. And so it really undermines the credibility of the United States and the world community if they implement a policy that is supposedly successful with all the criticisms that we have of it, and we have many, many criticisms. But then they undermine that end goal. It's really rather problematic in that sense. So I think, you know, whoever comes into, you know, whoever is elected next, hopefully it will be a progressive president. We will have a progressive president in the U.S. They will not only rethink policy towards the Middle East and towards Iran, but really rethink the use of sanctions. I mean, the U.S. has used sanctions against Cuba to, you know, without any end goal in mind, just because they don't like the, you know, a particular government or a particular regime, they sanction it, but it has no real political objective. And the problem with Trump administration is that, I think I read this actually earlier today, is that somebody had said that the problem is that there's nobody really advising the Trump administration on Iran policy, and that they're really dealing with Iran from a very ideological perspective. They don't have a logical policy. So hopefully whoever comes can reverse some of these policies.
Well, since our caller did mention Bernie Sanders, I think it's important to recognize that while Bernie Sanders didn't talk a lot about foreign policy in his last run for president, he has done a lot since then. And he has talked about Iran specifically in a long foreign policy speech, and he does it on a quite regular basis, as well as pushing legislation to stop the president from being able to do any military intervention. And one of the things I've appreciated about what Bernie Sanders has been doing about Iran is he goes back in history to 1953, and he talks about the U.S. intervention. He talks about the overthrowing of a democratically elected government, and he asks really critical questions like, what would Iran be like today if the CIA hadn't intervened to overthrow the elected government of Iran? And so he traces through the history the 1979 revolution. And Susan, you talked about sanctions in terms of the effect, particularly on the economic impact of it. But what has been the effect of since 1979 and then going up to today and this maximum pressure campaign? What is the space there for women to form organizations, to try to change policy in Iran, and what is the pushback they get from the hardliners?
I agree with you on your comments on Bernie Sanders. I think that, you know, Bernie Sanders has been much more vocal around foreign policy issues, and he does take a much more critical, you know, reflective approach to the Middle East and with respect to Iran. And he has many, you know, regular Iranians and many regular people from the Middle East actually like Bernie Sanders, just a personal take, because he seems to echo some of their longtime concerns about the power dynamics in the Middle East. And then the negative role that the U.S. has played in many of those countries, including in Iran. Sanctions, I mean, I think on one hand, you can say some sanctions have actually helped Iran rely a lot more on itself, which is positive. So I think Iran in that sense is very different than the other countries in the region that, you know, in many of the sectors, it has been able to rely on itself simply because it's been forced to do so by sanctions. You know, it has been deprived from relations with the West and deprived of many technologies as well. So Iran has been forced to produce that technology. So in some respect, while it has weakened and isolated Iran, it has also strengthened it in some capacity. So it's very difficult to compare Iran to many of the other countries that don't have the same level of industry and technological development. But, you know, the isolation, of course, is extremely problematic. It's extremely problematic for Iran, but it's extremely problematic for Iranians and for its civil society and social movement, because they're, like the country, they're also extremely isolated. And today we see the Iranian women that had, you know, flourished and had developed some relations with the, in the region and internationally during the reform period, during Khatami's presidency, which started in 1997 and went to 2005, I think 2004. You know, we saw the emergence of a sort of a organized civil society in the form of organizations, in particular the women's movement, and, you know, many of these groups and many of these activists were engaging internationally and had an opportunity to sort of present and reflect the issues that were important to them. But today you see the women's movement, as well as many, as well as pretty much all the other movements, extremely isolated from the international community and facing a lot of pressure inside the country. So, as you know, at the beginning of after President Rouhani was elected, you know, we really thought, so now it's been 5 years, 6 years since his election, in the sixth year after his election, we really thought that he would open up space for civil society. And he didn't do that, really. It wasn't his priority. I think he, unfortunately, his administration, they put all of their eggs in the sort of basket of you know, reestablishing relations with the international community through the Iran deal and solving the nuclear crisis, right? They didn't invest as much, or perhaps they're just not committed to investing as much in sort of opening up space internally. But civil society activists took opportunities that were presented anyway to begin to rebuild their movements and their organizations. But the last couple of years, especially since the U.S. pulling out of the Iran deal, we see sort of a more of a backlash against civil society inside the country. So not only is civil society and the women's movement isolated, more isolated than it's ever been before, that tiny bit of space that opened up is also shutting down very fast.
We've got just a few more minutes with Susan, and I think we have a couple of callers on the line. Go ahead, caller.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I appreciate all the analysis on the effects of sanctions and how that puts a lot. Hello?
Hello?
And how that puts a lot of stress on women, and I think that's not something that people, most Americans in the U.S. really think about. People don't see sanctions as an act of warfare. But I also just wanted to ask, I know Medea mentioned Israel as also pushing for a war with Iran, and I was wondering if one of you could elaborate on Israel's role in the region.
Ariel, you want to take
that? Sure, I'm happy to. So Israel has been pushing for a long time with war in Iran, and they pushed heavily in 2015 to try to prevent the Iran nuclear deal from coming into place. In the last couple of days, there was a joint test of a missile between the U.S. and Israel. It's the Arrow 3 missile, and they tested it in Alaska. And Netanyahu delighted with that, saying that it would give Israel the ability to act against missiles from Iran. But there's a real upside-downness here about which is the actual aggressor in this situation. And I think we have the same situation between the U.S. and Iran, where it's really backwards in terms of who is acting as the aggressor. This is entirely a manufactured crisis. I believe we have another caller as well, and just about two more minutes left with Susan.
I just wanted to add the hypocrisy of Israel with its probably 200 nuclear weapons that doesn't even admit it has any, and it pushing so hard for Iran not to get nuclear weapons. Now, we don't want anybody to have nuclear weapons, but the hypocrisy is not lost on the people of Iran. So, yes, caller? Caller?
Go ahead, caller.
Hello, yes, Miss. I would like for your guests there and the people there to give a history of the relationship between Iran and America, because until you deal with the history, you're not going to deal with the present situation over there. And I do think the problem lies is that Iran trying to counter what the U.S. and Israel is doing in that area, and they're in the way of what they really want to do, and they can't do it because Iran is right there in their way. And that seemed to be the problem. They never declared they wanted nuclear weapons, so they can just take that off the table. But it's just the aggressiveness of the people in the area there. They don't want to bring peace to the people that need it, but the people that are really the aggressors, nobody says anything about Saudi Arabia. You know, they breed terrorism.
Thanks so much, caller.
We have the Saudi Arabia segment coming up on our next session. And maybe, Suzanne, we only have a minute left.
Less than a minute even.
Wrap up your thoughts.
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, that historically the Iranian people have really, loved the American people. I think some of that is changing now with this level of pressure that the Americans are putting on Iranians. So when 9/11 happened, Iranian people held a spontaneous vigil, to honor the people who'd been killed. It's very sad to me to see this deterioration, this level of pressure that the U.S. is actually putting. They claim to be putting it on the Iranian government, but they're really putting it on the Iranian people. And it's dismantling our civil society, so we can't really be advocating for the rights that we need to advocate. We can't spend time pushing our governments to be accountable because we have a situation of war. So even if it's not outright conflict, it's economic warfare, and it's impacting the most vulnerable groups the most. So I hope that we see some change in policy on the U.S. side and that we can have negotiations and come to peace. It's important for the entire Middle East, not just for Iran, but particularly for Iranians. But thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Suzanne, for being with us on the show and for the wonderful work you're doing. This is Code Pink Radio, and we are on both WPFW and WBAI. We'll take a short break now. If anybody wants to contact us directly, you can reach us at radio@codepink.org, and we'll be back with a new segment on Saudi Arabia. Back with Code Pink Radio, and we have an exciting new segment. Remember, if you want to call in, be part of the discussion, you can do that at 202-588-0893. And we're very excited about our next guest, who is Ben Freeman with the Center for International Policy, a great organization. And Ben is the director of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative, where he works to expose foreign governments and how they're influencing U.S. policy. And he's done some fantastic work on exposing the lobby groups that have been representing the Saudi government and how that has influenced U.S. policy. So, Ben, thank you for being with us.
I just want to say also exposing think tanks and that they're not transparent about the money that they receive from foreign governments.
So, Ben, are you on the line with us?
I am. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you, Ben. So why don't you start out telling us about some of your most recent research?
Yeah, happy to. We've been looking at the Saudi influence operation, or I sometimes call it the Saudi lobbying juggernaut, because it's really gigantic. Right now, the Saudis have more than 20 firms that are registered to either do lobbying work or to do public relations work for them in the U.S. In the past 2 years, they've spent over $40 million on this gigantic influence operation. They have over 100 registered foreign agents working for them, again, right now. And basically what they're doing is they're trying to convince the U.S. to side with them in the war in Yemen. They're doing a lot of work right now regarding Iran and effectively trying to get the U.S. to start another war in the Middle East against Iran. And they're also, they've been doing a pretty effective job at getting a lot of U.S. policymakers to really turn a blind eye to the human rights abuses and just the egregious record of the regime in Saudi Arabia.
So could you tell us about how things have changed since the death of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, the attitude, the way the businesses are dealing with Saudi Arabia, some of the PR firms, the think tanks? How has the terrain shifted?
Yeah, it was really a watershed moment, the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And what we saw kind of before and after that was when the incident actually happened, you did see several of their lobbying and public relations firms. They dropped the Saudis as a client after that, I think for obvious reasons, you know, the just brutal murder of a Washington Post columnist. Jamal Khashoggi was living in the U.S., after the brutal murder, you saw several of the firms drop the Saudis as a client. You saw several think tanks, including the Brookings Institution, say they were no longer going to accept money from Saudi Arabia. In all these stories, they made headlines, and you know, there was a huge backlash against the Saudis at the time, and you know, so people really focused in on all these firms and places that were kind of turning against the Saudis. But then the story kind of fell off the radar. And if you fast forward now, you know, almost 10 months later, unfortunately, the Saudi influence machine is still going as strong as ever. As I mentioned earlier, the Saudis still have over 20 firms working on their behalf, over 100 registered foreign agents working for them, and they're still giving out money lavishly all over town. Additionally, several high-profile universities who are funded extensively by the Saudis, they actually came out and said they were not going to drop their support from Saudi Arabia. And that includes Ivy League universities, like both Harvard and MIT, who, when Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman came to the U.S. in early 2018, he did this sort of roadshow across the U.S., where, you know, he met dignitaries in the U.S., he met military leaders across the nation, even went out to Hollywood and had dinner with The Rock and Oprah, and then he came back and toured a lot of elite American universities, including Harvard and MIT, and sort of put this glossy image over a guy who, as we now know, is complicit in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. So I think what was actually telling about the brutal murder of Khashoggi is not the firms that did stop working with the Saudis. I think the bigger question is, why are so many of these lobbying and PR firms and universities and think tanks still doing business with the Saudis after everything we know?
So I saw 2 days ago, really exciting news. The Arabia Foundation is closing its doors, and the reason that they're citing is differences of opinion among their donors, and this is one of the think tanks. I'm sure you can tell us a bit more about it.
Yeah, absolutely. That was very exciting news. I completely agree. Surprising news, because the Arabia Foundation, to provide a little more background, it's a I'm putting the word think tank in air quotes here. Because I think that's a generous description for what the Arabia Foundation did. I think a more accurate description of the Arabia Foundation is that it was really a mouthpiece for the Saudi regime's apologists in the U.S. It was funded by some private citizens, but private citizens who with very close ties to the regime in Saudi Arabia. And so most of the Arabia Foundation's, products, again, I'm going to put that in air quotes, most of these products, they were really just talking points from the administration. In fact, we found some instances where their public statements and their press releases were actually the exact same talking points that Saudi registered foreign agents we're also distributing. And so I think for us, and I think for your listeners out there, I think it's worth asking the question of where is the line between somebody who is a registered foreign agent for a country like Saudi Arabia, and where's the line between that person and somebody who's working at a think tank that's completely funded by folks who are sympathetic to the Saudi regime. If they're using the same talking point, spouting the same line, making the same apologies for civilian casualties in Yemen, why is one of these people registered as a foreign agent in the other somehow able to label themselves a quote-unquote expert at a think tank?
Well, that's right. And we have been using your research in our own work. And Ariel, maybe you can tell a little bit about the Saudi boycott campaign. Some people, the listeners might know about the campaign around boycotting Israel, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement. And there have been many people who were constantly saying, well, why don't you boycott some of these terrible Arab countries? And we at Code Pink have been doing precisely that. And, Ariel, talk a little bit about the Saudi boycott campaign.
Sure. So in 2018, we, along with a broad coalition, were part of this work that, as you were talking about, where we saw companies, dozens of companies and notables from the New York Times to the CEO of Uber and so many others pull out of what was, at that time, they were having a conference, the Saudi Future Investment Initiative. And later we saw Endeavor.
And that was because it was right after the murder
yes.
of Jamal Khashoggi. Has been
and
missing.
Then also related to the murder, in March of this year, talent agency Endeavor returned a $400 million investment from the Saudis. That's a whole lot of money. So we've also been heavily focused on getting musicians and artists not to perform in Saudi Arabia. And we've been asking numerous of them, from Mariah Carey to the Black Eyed Peas. And just recently, we campaigned to get Nicki Minaj to cancel her performance in Saudi Arabia. And it was, I think, less than 2 weeks before she was scheduled to perform when she announced that she would not be showing up for that concert. And she cited in her reasons Saudi Arabia's treatment of women and of LGBTQ individuals. Now, this made major, major headlines. Nicki Minaj, for anyone who's not familiar with her, is a pretty big name. And we expect and hope to see further victories. I want to encourage our listeners to get involved. There's two ways to get involved with our Boycott Saudi Arabia campaign. You can go to our website, codepink.org/boycottsaudi, and you can also email us at radio@codepink.org. And I also want to remind our listeners of the number to call in with questions. That's 202-588-0893.
And we do have a caller on the air. Caller, you there?
Oh, hiya. Let me turn off the radio. Hello, this is Bob from Brooklyn, New York.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah, I'm calling about Saudi Arabia. I'm a volunteer member of Amnesty International, and we have local chapters all over the world, and we have a local chapter in Brooklyn. And our group, among other things, is working on a Saudi Arabia human rights campaign. And, you know, we get people to sign petitions and write letters and send postcards to the government of Saudi Arabia and to the embassy and our own government. Now, of course, the human rights situation in Saudi Arabia, a lot of attention has been focused on Jamal Khashoggi, rightly so, and on the violation of human rights of women, especially when it comes to driving. But the situation is so much more egregious than just Jamal Khashoggi and women not being able to drive. About a year ago, about a dozen or so women were just rounded up and imprisoned just because they wanted some political freedom. But also there's a nascent, or there was a nascent human rights organization in Saudi Arabia called ACPRA, Association for Civil and Political Rights in Arabia. And there were about 15 or 20 members, and every one of them was put in prison and given very long prison terms. And they're prisoners of conscience. They were just making a peaceful expression. They just want some democracy. And the leader of the group, Raif Badawi, was sentenced to 1,000 lashes. So, you know, there's a lot of people are not aware of just how serious the situation is over there. And I'm hoping, you know, if people want, people do have an option. They can join Amnesty International if you'd like to get involved in all kinds of human rights situations all over the world and in the United States.
Well, thank you, Bob. And I do want to say how this kind of work hasn't been able to get Raif Badawi out of prison, but because of Amnesty International and the others who have expressed their outrage, the Saudi government did stop after the first 50 lashes. He was supposed to be receiving them on a regular basis. They haven't done that since because somebody did manage to videotape that and put that out in the world. So this kind of pressure is important. And Ben, do you want to respond?
Yeah. Bob, thank you very much for the work you're doing. That's wonderful. And I, as always, I'm in awe of everything that Code Pink does to raise awareness for these issues and to really go after some of the companies and some of the individuals that are working with a regime like this. And I think it's so important to do that because we may not realize it, but a lot of the, you know, whether it's Nicki Minaj or some other celebrity you know or some company that you might really like, you know, chances are there's some connection to one of these authoritarian regimes, whether it's the Saudis or the Emiratis. And I think it's imperative on us as Americans to, you know, to do our part and to boycott anybody who's going to work with a regime like this. I'm very happy. The one silver lining, I think, about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and this is what Bob alluded to, was it's really just the tip of the iceberg. I think it really opened people's eyes up to exactly what type of regime this is in Saudi Arabia. You know, this is not a liberal democracy, and on just about every metric of human rights and even just human decency, this is an incredibly oppressive regime, and it's incumbent on us do everything we can to change U.S. foreign policy with Saudi Arabia.
We heard something really exciting recently. Representative Rashida Tlaib, she was on CNN with Jake Tapper, and she was talking about the boycott of Israel. And she got asked the most common question that you get asked in this situation, well, why aren't you boycotting other countries like Saudi Arabia? And Rashida replied, if there's an organized boycott of Saudi Arabia, I'll be the first to get on it. So I'm wondering if you have if any comments on that and thoughts on how to let our representatives know that this is a tool that can be used.
Yeah, absolutely. My new colleague here, his name is Sanjeev Berry, he has started a program at the Center for International Policy called Freedom Forward, and his first objective in this new organization is exactly this. It is a boycott of Saudi Arabia. You can find out more about his work at freedomforward.org or on our website at internationalpolicy.org. But yeah, happy to, I'm sure Sanjeev would be happy to partner with Code Pink, partner with folks at Amnesty. Bob, I hope you're still listening. But there's plenty of work to be done here, and we're happy to help lead the charge in it.
Well, absolutely. And we should mention that there has been fantastic work on in Congress to try to stop U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen. And that has been a broad-based coalition with humanitarian organizations, human rights groups, even some conservative and libertarian groups, and has we have managed to get majority votes in both the House and the Senate that unfortunately have been vetoed when they get up to the White House. But this is important work, and we will all keep going on this. I think we have a caller. Caller, you there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hello, Code Pink?
Yes. Who are you and where are you from?
Hi, my name is Mike Levinson. I work with the War Resisters League, and I think this is a great program. I think Code Pink is one of the liveliest groups on the left.
And we love War Resisters. Thank you.
We work great together. You know, you mentioned earlier, you know, I think your speaker was making a rhetorical point because I think he knows the answer. He said, why are we allowing the Saudis to do this? Well, when the journalist was murdered, Donald Trump's first remark was, it's too bad that he was killed, but we don't want to blow a $1 billion arms sales deal. And that's what it's all about. The war makers in Washington, they're making billions and billions of dollars selling weapons to the Saudis. They're making war in the Middle East. And that's obviously more important to them than human rights.
Absolutely. And Ben, you recently did a report on the weapons companies and what they are selling to Saudi Arabia and making. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure.
Yes. These weapons that are going there are involved in the bombing of Yemen. The bombs are being dropped on the school buses and the ports. They're all American-made weapons. Raytheon, other companies, Lockheed. They're American companies. We're selling the weapons. We're advising the pilots. We're giving them the intelligence information, which targets to hit. You know, so we're running that war. It's not like we're sitting by idly and simply advising them.
Yes.
We're in charge of that war.
Absolutely. Ben, we want to hear a little from Ben about the report that they just put out. I think is extremely useful for our listeners.
Yeah. Think I completely agree with what Mark just said there. And to that point, the report that we put out, my colleagues Cassandra Simpson and Bill Hartung, they did a lot of great research, and they tracked down every single Saudi arms sale from the U.S. To Saudi Arabia in the last 10 years. And we're talking about more than $100 billion in arms sales to the kingdom. And again, you can find that on our website. We were fortunate enough to have Bernie Sanders tweet out the report, too. So there are a lot of eyeballs that have been on that report. And for me, it's very eye-opening because exactly to Mark's point, a lot of those weapons that we have sold them have been directly tied to airstrikes in the war in Yemen and directly tied to airstrikes that have brutally killed civilians in Yemen. Including the bombing of school buses, bombings at weddings, bombings at markets. There's a very direct line between U.S. arms sales and U.S. bombs to killing civilians in Yemen. And again, it's imperative we do everything we can to stop that.
And these two issues, Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Mark, I think we're going to have to cut you off because we're coming to the end of this segment. But we appreciate your call in. And Ben, we so appreciate the work that you have been doing. And we hope people will go to the Center for International Policy website and check it out. And go to the Code Pink website, check out our work, codepink.org, or you can contact us at radio@codepink.org.
You're listening to Code Pink Radio on WPFW and WBAI.
Come back next week, Thursday, same time, 11 a.m. Thank you. They feed you lies, don't want you to think. They say Code Terror, we say Code Pink, freedom, Code Pink, for peace, Code Pink, to hunger and war have ceased. Code Pink, for women, boys, men.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. What a fabulous presentation. Code Pink. Brand new, just kicking off a joint collaboration between WBAI and WPFW in Washington, D.C. Now, WBAI is in its summer membership and fundraising drive, and we thank you so much. The program that you just heard airs Thursdays at 11 a.m., and it's aired here because of listeners just like you. So as we're in our fundraising drive, we're asking you to become members of the station, to become a WBAI buddy in support of this program. 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602.
So how fabulous is it to have Code Pink Radio on the air, Michael?
It is as fabulous as having the joint collaboration between WBAI and WPFW. That's what I'm so excited about.
It's very cool.
It is. It really
is. It should have happened long ago.
Long ago. That's true. That's
but it's
true.
Happening now.
It's happening right now, and that is really exciting. Very happy about that.
So we are in week two of our fun drive, our summer fun drive, and we're looking for you to become WBAI members, to become a buddy, a Code Pink radio buddy. Can you do that now? Can you give us a call? 516-620-3602. Did you tell folks what they get?
No, I didn't tell them how to become a BAI buddy. I just started on that. Again, I'm really excited. You're joining us, the whole radio audience, in the studio now, and we're telling them about BAI buddies and what you can do and how you can become a BAI buddy. And in fact, on Monday, you told me some additional ways that you could become BAI buddies. I didn't even know you could become a BAI buddy for a $5 contribution.
A dollar.
I'm hesitant to say that, but that's true, I guess. A dollar.
A dollar a month. $5 a month.
Oh, wow.
$10 a month. Whatever it is. And what happens is this gives WBAI a sustained income. This is a way that we can know that we have a certain amount of money to keep the lights on, to pay for the transmitter bill. You know, this fund drive is what will get us through till October. I know it's very hand-to-mouth here, but we do not take any money from any corporations at all. No one. Nothing. Nada. So we need you to call in and become a listener sponsor. Coming up really soon is the Gary Null Show, and I know you're tuning in for that, but can you please call now? Can we see a first caller? 516-620-3602, $25 to become a member for a full year, or $10 a month to become a WBAI buddy. And I'm going to put this book in with your buddy membership into the wonderful tote bag that you receive when you become a buddy. It's a beautiful, nice, big tote bag you can put your groceries in. And I'm going to put in Inside Iran. That's Medea Benjamin's book. I know when it came out just a short while ago, I just sat there, read through the whole thing, and outlined it as if I was in college, just because it's so interesting. And she's such a good writer, and she's such a good person. And I love the whole the Code Pink group. So if you love Code Pink as much as I do, if you love the idea of supporting a women's peace group, which is on the radio, Code Pink Radio, and if you love the idea of WBAI listeners-sponsored free speech radio in New York, then give us a call. 516-620-3602. I see some calls are coming in. Can you please join that caller? You're going to be hearing Code Pink every Thursday from 11 to 12 o'clock. And before that, you have Black Lives Matter from...
With Shivona,
with
that's
Shivana,
right.
With mm-hmm. Yes, Shivana. From 10 to 11. And before that, you have Equal Rights and Justice. Is that how Mimi calls
that's
it?
That's right. Equal
see
Rights
that?
And Justice.
I know the whole sketch.
Yes, you do. But you know something, Linda? Medea Benjamin, she goes all around the world to flashpoints all around the world. And the fact that you're putting this book into the tote bag is really fabulous. Inside Iran by Medea Benjamin. Fantastic. She is one of the co-founders of Code Pink. And we're asking you to join us to become members of this station, become a BAI buddy, and support us.
516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. You have one more minute to call WBAI to become a WBAI buddy. Read about the paradoxical status of Iranian women. Read about why the Baha'i discriminated are being discriminated against. read about religious freedom for some, but not for all. That's in Medea Benjamin's book, Inside Iran, which we're going to throw in to your buddy subscription.
And you know, I started to call you Ginger. I'm sorry, Linda.
Oh, Linda. My.
Sorry.
That's his.
That's my beloved. Sorry.
That's his woman.
The Saudi boycott campaign. We know a lot about
BDS,
mm-hmm. but the Saudi boycott campaign, that's what they were talking about in the previous segment. So this is really exciting. This will come to you as a thank you gift by calling 516-620-3602.
And thank you so much. Thank you for supporting WBAI. Stay tuned now for The Gary Null Show.